Okay, well, welcome back to the Undergraduate Research Podcast. We are continuing to talk about research issues with our different faculty on campus, and tonight's guest is Dr. James LaPlante. He is Dean of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. His PhD is from the University of Oklahoma. Dr. LaPlante has taught courses on Southern culture and politics, conspiracy theories, American politics in the age of Donald Trump. He regularly teaches both undergrad and graduate courses on quantitative research methods and has dealt with topics in his research from policy diffusion to Southern politics to parties in the Czech Republic. He has published a great many articles, and is quite the scholar. And when it comes to undergraduate research, he was the person in charge at VSU for 20, 25 years. And so we are just thrilled to have you here, Dr. LaPlante, and taking the time to be with us and talk to us about research.
Well, it's a pleasure, my friend. Thanks for having me. And as you know, I mean, this is really my favorite topic to discuss.
It is. Well, we'll jump right in. And let me ask you the first question, because I gave you a set of questions. What areas of research? I gave a few and kind of brief, but can you give us more specifics on the areas of research you've been involved in, and maybe what was your favorite project or what was your least favorite project and why?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, as you kind of nicely summarized at the beginning, a lot of my research initially was on policy diffusion across the American states. So, you know, why do certain policies spread very quickly across the states or governmental jurisdictions? It doesn't have to necessarily be states. Why do other policies diffuse slowly? What are some of the key predictors of that? You know, then we developed a study abroad program and a faculty exchange program with the Czech Republic. So I had a really cool opportunity to collaborate with faculty at Palický University in Olomouc. And so I did some research on political parties in the Czech Republic. They actually have a communist party. I mean, this is an unrepentant dyed in the wool, communist party that we looked at some of the electoral support for that party. And then more recently, I've kind of expanded into, Georgia politics, elections in Georgia, and actually gun policy, looking at gun sales from the end of the Clinton presidency all the way through the Trump presidency has been the most recent project that I've been involved in. And actually, we just got that published within the last month. And I would say that's, to your other question, so that's probably been my favorite project, just because look at the pandemic, look at all the social unrest. Yeah. Gun sales have been going through the roof this year.
Wow.
Although they've been going through the roof, one might argue, for many, many years now. And I was I had the opportunity to work with my daughter, who was an undergraduate here at VSU. She now teaches at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. So she was the lead author on that time series study of gun sales in the United States from, again, the late Clinton presidency through the summer of 2020. And it was just a blast to work with her on it.
Oh, I bet. I bet. I mean, that's unusual to find families being able to publish together. I am surprised to hear that you all found that gun sales, I mean, I knew they went up, but I didn't know they were really skyrocketing at this point.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, what we find in the study is that while gun sales have, you know, increased really from the end of the Clinton presidency in the late 1990s to the present, right? So roughly 20 years, they really exploded during the Obama presidency. And Obama has even commented on this, that the best thing that ever happened for the gun industry was Barack Obama. And believe me, that was never his intention. He would tell you that was never his intention. So as polarization has expanded in this country, gun sales have escalated, and then during the pandemic, and also with the higher profile of Black Lives Matter, various social protests, gun sales have taken off. And what we looked at was South versus non-South. So we looked at how much of this was being driven by the 11 former Confederate states. And as you might imagine, the most precipitous increases were, of course, in Southern states during the Obama presidency. So there's a bit of racial politics at play there. So yeah, it was a very, very cool study, and it was fascinating to look at 20 years of data by month. We looked at FBI background checks. So that was our proxy for gun sales, right? Because
Right.
so many gun sales are at gun shows, or the trunk out of somebody's car, or the back seat out of somebody's car, or somebody's garage. So we fully admitted that FBI background checks would be an incomplete proxy for that.
Right.
But nonetheless, the patterns were breathtaking in terms of gun sales and which party controls the White House, and the effect of the Christmas holidays, and the effect of mass shootings, and the effect of media coverage of mass shootings. So, those are all things that we looked at.
Oh, wow. And do you think then, because you do also teach conspiracy theory, do you think that that had something to do with the increase of sales, or that's fueling part of this, I guess, fear of each other?
Oh yeah, right. So there's this notion, especially after mass shootings, that the government is coming for our guns, the government is coming for our ammo, the Second Amendment will go away, the deep state will do X, Y, and Z. And really, up until Sandy Hook, Obama did not want to tackle gun control, right? I mean, he just said, look, we're going to focus on health care, we're going to focus on other issues. That's a really
Right.
difficult, divisive issue. So, I mean, some of it is just fear-based politics, and that's
Right.
nothing new. But oh yeah, my friend, you're exactly right. I mean, there's plenty of conspiratorial thinking that I think drives these purchases, that drives ammo sales, and that kind of conspiratorial thinking has really been on display the last 2 months. Of course, in the wake of the election.
Yeah, it's been amazing to watch. Things that I never thought would have occurred have occurred. It's
Well,
like
yeah, and
looking at a
I mean, I
different
said to my
nation.
class, oh, yeah, I said to my class earlier today that the course is called Conspiracy Theories in American Politics. When I teach it again next spring, I'm thinking of just calling it American Politics. That's where we're at.
That is where we are, and that's a frightening place. I know that I may be older than you, but I know that being around from the 60s, even looking at what happened there versus what's happening now, it just seems a whole different world to me in terms of what's going on and the types of protests and the types of violence that's being pushed forward. So, but I think there's something that goes back to that, to the 60s era and the change, of course, the racial issues. So I don't know
Yeah.
what to do with that. I may need to take your class.
Well, it really, so yeah, I mean, there are racial dimensions. There are certainly racial dimensions here. What's interesting, we talk about this in our paper, gun sales among African Americans. Gun sales among African Americans have especially
Wow.
exploded in 2020, and many of them are first-time gun owners. Many African Americans are first-time gun owners in 2020, the data we had, but then also across racial groups and across age groups. You have tremendous numbers of people who are first-time gun owners that were making purchases during the pandemic. But we, Christine and I and some other colleagues also looked at campus carry. What are the factors that lead
Right.
states to adopt concealed carry on college campuses? And we found it was most likely to occur in southern states that had a high percentage African American or high percentage Hispanic population. And that's right with the literature on Stand Your Ground. If you look at the 25
Yeah.
or so states that that have adopted Stand Your Ground, being a southern state and having a large Latino population, aka Texas, Florida, or having a large African American population, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi. Those are huge predictors of Stand Your Ground, but then also campus carry. So yeah, it's I mean, I'm just increasingly, and I'm not quite sure how I got into this area. Sometimes you just meander and all of a sudden,
Right.
you're doing all kinds of research on gun policy, but it is a really good lens. I guess gun sales, quite frankly, are a really good lens to studying polarization, consumerism, racial threat, racial fear, protest movements. Yeah, I mean, it brings all of that together.
That's amazing. Well, in that line, what sort of obstacles in your research here in what we're talking about now or in other research, have you had to overcome? And what were your strategies for overcoming them?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I mean, really my biggest challenge is just the administrative position I'm in. Although I'm very sensitive to faculty members who are teaching four or five or more classes. Oh my gosh, it's the same thing. Finding time, right? I mean, where do we carve out time for research when we're busy teaching? And then people like deans, those darn deans put us on this committee and that committee. And so how do we find, or provost in my case, I wind up on other committees. So, finding time for research has
Yeah.
really been my greatest challenge. And then finding data, right? Because there might be really cool questions we want to ask. I mean, I'm a quantitative researcher, so I should have said that at the
Right.
start. I mean, I gather data by state, by county, by city, by country, whatever, by legislator, by voter, and I analyze it quantitatively, mostly survey research, but a lot of it is public records and election data, run regression models, multivariate models. So again, to I'm totally a quantitative researcher. Sometimes you have really cool questions, or there's a cool variable that you want to look at, but you just can't quite get the data. So how do I deal with the time issue? How do I deal with trying to get the data? Collaboration, collaboration, collaboration. So what I've learned is, now as a full professor and a full-time administrator, working with graduate students, I really started working with Christina when she was in our doctoral program. I've worked with
Right.
our doctoral students at VSU, undergraduates at VSU. So, I love a project that has two, three, four, five co-authors. We divvy up the tasks. We send people down a rabbit hole looking for data where they may or may not find what we need. But that's really been, I mean, that's kind of been my approach the last 10 years, is to collaborate with our wonderful undergraduates and our graduate students, and then give them the lead authorship. Let them run with the
Right.
project. And right, I'm in the caboose. I don't need the publication. So, I mean,
Right.
I'm happy to be the fifth author, or I don't even have to be an author on it, but let them drive the bus, drive the train. I'm hopefully providing some advice along the way, and that's worked well, I think.
It's interesting to me that many times when you work with graduate students or undergrad, because they come at it from a brand new perspective, you may see things that you never thought of. I mean, I do all the time because
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
so used to looking at things through one lens, and I'm a qualitative researcher. So, you get used to one way of doing it, and then you have these students who do something entirely different.
Well, thank you. I love that point. Because I think the worst thing we can do is say, well, I've been here 25 years, or I've been doing research for 30 years, so I have all the answers and I know more than everybody. Oh my God, no. You're right. I mean, I learn from the fresh perspective of my undergraduates and graduate students. Again, I'm a qualitative or I'm a quantitative guy. I mean, I understand qualitative research. I just don't largely do it. So when my students suggest a mixed methods approach where we're going to be blending quantitative and qualitative approaches, oh my gosh, I value that. I learn from that. Or my quantitative students who have studied more advanced modeling than me since I went to graduate school long, long, long ago.
Yes.
Yeah, I benefit from all of that. So I love your point and would echo it.
Yeah, I mean, and that is true. When I look at some of the things coming out and I think about, well, when I was in graduate school, wow, that was a long time ago. So, yes, things have changed. And it's nice to have students pushing you to adapt to that.
I know, I was just talking to my daughter about this over the weekend, or maybe one of our new faculty. And I said, I mean, I'm just volunteering myself because I know I need this. I mean, I could really use a semester or two back in a PhD program. And what I mean by that is learning the literature, right?
Yes.
So spending a semester or two where I'm combing all the journals, I'm reading all the latest books, and I can get up to speed on, I mean, my core areas are political socialization. That was my dissertation so long ago, but political socialization, campaigns and elections, policy diffusion. I mean, I need to go back to graduate school for a couple of semesters to get abreast of all the
That
literature.
would, you know,
But
you're right. That would be wonderful.
yeah, but so I mean, I know we're not going to have an administrative leave program for that. So, working with newly minted PhDs or
Yeah.
master students or even our undergraduates, that's a way to keep me up to date.
Yeah, I think that's great. When you do your research, I'm wondering how you do it because I always find it interesting, and I think students do too. For instance, when I go to write and research, I mean, my family knows not to come in, not to bother me. You know, they're going to get their own food or they're going to starve. My kids are pretty good about it. They grew up knowing me that if I start writing, I'm going to write for the next 48 hours. What are some of the ways that you have your methodologies of writing and researching?
Yeah, so I was thinking about that as you were summarizing your approach. I mean, just again, kind of the nature of my position is that it's darn near impossible to find, a block of a day or two or a
Yeah.
week. And so it's really just a matter of stealing time. And I've never been good at this. I still need work on it, but it's really hard to write for an hour here or 30 minutes there, or
Yeah.
in your car during the lunch break while you're reading an article and you're scribbling notes. But that's kind of where I'm at now, my friend. I mean, I've just tried to,
Yeah.
where I can steal an hour, where I can steal 2 hours, or maybe the email stops and everything gets quiet at 10 o'clock. And I'm like, okay, from 11 to 2, from 11:02, I can pull together some tables or figures, or write a couple of pages. But although I would say it goes back to my previous point on collaboration. I mean, a lot of what I'm doing now is more like, editor and conductor, right? So we'll do
Right.
Teams, where we'll do a virtual meeting, or when we used to meet all face to face, and we would outline it, and we'd. So I'd like to say I'd like to think I can help in terms of divvying up tasks. Okay, your strength is literature review. Your strength is data collection, data analysis. Your strength is pulling all of this together in a summary or discussion. So I hope I'm able now at this stage to kind of conduct and help edit and then write where I need to. But the reality is I just probably could not do a solo project on my own, just given,
Yeah.
various time constraints. But when I think back to my dissertation, it was largely a summer. It was 3 solid months where I just wrote and wrote and wrote. I looked at middle school students. I surveyed 1,000 middle school students
Oh,
in
wow.
Oklahoma City public schools, and I looked at the role of family, peer groups, the media, and groups, school groups, community groups, writ large. So I looked at the different agents of socialization, and I'd been working on it for 2 years, but it was taking an entire summer and not teaching. And I wrote almost all of that in 3 months, and that was a great summer. Just get up every day and write and analyze, and
Yeah.
God, I loved that. I mean, I miss that. I miss being able to do that. So now my role,
Yeah.
is really more of conductor, editor, and then prodding people. Hey, we need the lit review, or we need you to revise this, or okay, we got the revise and resubmit, so all the reviews are in. And I mean, you've been there, and now we need to
Yep.
maybe write. Now we need to maybe write a whole new paper based upon what
Yeah.
the reviewers want. So I'd like to think that's where my wisdom, however much I have, helping these young authors navigate the revise and resubmit process, that's where maybe I I can make my strongest contribution.
Well, I think that's an incredible contribution, because one of the things I know from talking to some of our students that have gone on to grad school is that they don't know how to go about any of this process. If they've gone through the process with a professor in the undergrad, then they know how to bring together a team, and they know what to do when they get a rewrite and resubmit, that it's not a horrible thing, that it does mean you're going to have to restructure a lot, but it also means that they liked what you did. And then you have to pick and choose what you're going to fix and then defend why you're not going to change something else. So what you're doing is incredibly valuable.
Well, and I really like that point too, because so you have three peer reviewers, and let's say they all give you three pages of comments. And by the time you put that in a table and you look at all the revisions, oh my God, it can be daunting. But to your point, I remind my younger co-authors, it is infinitely better than a rejection. It is yes. Infinitely better than the editor rejecting out of hand, which he or she might do, or the reviewers rejecting. And you got a lot of comments because they really gave you a detailed, thoughtful evaluation. And seeing that paper, right? I remember my daughter telling me that one of the most enjoyable parts of working on the campus carry, the concealed carry on college campuses, is that the reviewers gave us a boatload of comments, just comment after comment after comment. But we had such a stronger paper. We had such a stronger paper when we were done. And she says, I can't believe how far the paper has come. And I said, oh, exactly, my dear. That's the peer review. That's the peer review process at its best.
It is. And I think teaching students that when you get these things, yes, it's going to hurt. I mean, you're going to feel like, oh, no. But you need to rephrase it into, we're all making this better. You know, don't take it so personally.
Oh, exactly. And I find myself, even after all these years, you know, when I see pages and pages and pages of comments, like, how could they dismantle what we're doing?
Yes.
And then you wade your way through it, and you find yourself nodding, going, we could have been clearer there. Oh, yeah, here's a better variable to use. Oh, here's a better source of data. So many things in life, right? So many things in life. With critique, with constructive criticism, oh my God, embrace it, hug it, envelop it, and don't bow up your back and say, well my writing's perfect. And by the way, how dare anybody question my analysis?
Yeah, that may be your first reaction because it hurts, but then I'm amazed at how much better everything I have written has been with the peer review, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
Even if I don't agree with the peer review, and there's times when I don't, taking into consideration what they're saying, I have often even put in my paper or my books why this I don't agree with this. Like, put in their point, but explain better why their point isn't there without naming them, of course, because we don't know who they are.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there's a lot to seeing it that way.
And I would think for our undergraduates and graduate students, right, we're helping them become better peer reviewers. And it doesn't mean an undergraduate has to go on to graduate school or get a PhD, right? I mean, an undergraduate in any of our disciplines, in any of our fields, will be a peer reviewer. They may be reviewing a technical report for a city or county government. They may be reviewing a draft bill in the Georgia General Assembly or the U.S. Congress, right? So no matter where our wonderful students go, they are going to be peer reviewers of writing, of ideas, of documents their entire life. And how do they do that well? And so, again, I mean, I don't know that I've ever really talked much about it, but as we're discussing this, that is a huge benefit of the undergraduate research enterprise is teaching our students or mentoring our students how to be a better peer reviewer.
I love that. I've never thought of it in that terms, but now that you say that, that's a wonderful assessment of what's going on. And honestly, I think something that we should build on, at least I would like to take that if it's all right with you, and even use it in other areas to explain to students why we are teaching them to do this, because I think that's brilliant.
Well, you know, I just, you know, my wife reminds me, who teaches in English here, you know, that we think about English 1101 and our freshman students, our wonderful freshmen, and how they peer review each paper or peer review each other's papers. And then, I don't know, that maybe kind of fades away, and maybe we come back to peer review in our upper division classes, maybe or maybe not, or maybe we encourage them to submit to our VSU undergraduate research Omnino, and then they see peer reviews, or you know, you work with your students and they right. publish in a disciplinary journal. But yeah, how do we take all those experiences together and say, this is the art, and it is an art. This is the art of peer review, and I don't care what job or what field you go into, you will peer review your coworkers. Memos, technical reports, draft legislation, or, you know, draft reports, whatever.
Yeah.
Press
releases. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
Well, I do have a couple more questions for you. One of them is, what is your least favorite or most favorite part of research? Like, I love delving into things, works and that nobody else has ever found, or they've been in hiding for so long, unique stuff. But I going through and editing like the bibliography and things like that just makes me crazy. So what are areas you like and dislike?
Yeah. So again, I also like that question, my friend. I don't know if it's a cheating answer. I mean, to some degree, it's almost the same answer. So when we build a data set, right? So let's say it's a really big data set, like I mentioned earlier, the late 1990s, all the way through the summer of 2020, gun background checks for all 50 states by year for every single month. Pretty big data set.
Oh, wow.
When we hit, and so whether it's SPSS or Stata, or, you know, whatever software package you're using, you say, okay, these are the six most important predictors, right? So, okay, these are my six or eight or 10, based upon the literature review and previous studies. These are what I think are the key predictors of gun sales. And then you hit the submit button, right? So you build the model, you're clicking away. Yeah. That moment right before we see the results is literally my favorite part of the project, because what did we find? What did we find? Were our hypotheses properly formulated? Are we going to find something that really fascinates us or causes us to scratch our heads? It can also be my least favorite part when you click and run that multivariate model and you don't find a damn thing. I mean, nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, by random chance, you should have discovered more than you did, or we would say explained more of the variance of the dependent variable. And so I tease my students and they're like, oh, almost in tears. They're like, what if I find nothing? Right, Dr. Plant, I built this data set, and what if I find nothing? I'm like, oh, you can still make an A, right? I mean, this doesn't have to be publishable to make an A in research methods. And then I teased them. I said, well, that's a James LaPlante paper. If you've coded data all semester, you're so super excited and you find nothing. I mean, again, random chance tells us you should have discovered more. That's a James LaPlante paper all too often. So that moment when you're on the precipice of seeing the statistical analysis, seeing the statistical results, still, I mean, this was true in graduate school, and it's still true for me well into my career, that right before I get the printout and analyze the results, that's my favorite. And it can also be my least favorite part of the process.
Yeah, because we all run into those where we think we have this great idea, and then, wow, it's just not there.
Maybe you get a conference paper out of it. You're sure in the heck are never going to publish it. You move on. And so I now say this the first week of class, because I had students early on almost in tears. And right. So they would come to me with their printouts and they would say, nothing is statistically significant. You know, I don't have a single statistically significant variable. And almost in tears. And I said, no, you've done everything the assignment has asked for. We're not going to publish it. That's okay. But this is still an A paper.
Yeah. I guess sometimes you got to find out that there's nothing to find out.
Yeah. Or you got to get better data, right? You don't have the right data, or you're measuring it at the wrong level. You're measuring something at the county or precinct level when really you need individual level survey data. These are all teachable moments.
Exactly. Well, that leads me to my last question, and that is, what advice do you want to give to the students about research who are listening to this?
Again, my friend, I appreciate the invitation, and I like that question. I would say, to steal a line from Nike, I think it's Nike, right? Just do it. Just do it. I mean, I'm amazed by how often students will say, "Oh, I don't know that I can do it," or "I don't know that I can present it. I don't know that I can really present my paper, or do a poster, or do a 3-minute video, all the beautiful things that you coordinate with your team for our campus-wide symposium." So part of it is just to get over that fear, to get over those reservations, and I mean, I compare it to gardening, and I don't know if this is a good analogy, but I said in class, you're going to get your hands dirty with data, right? Like digging into a garden, and sometimes you have to use manure maybe get some beautiful flowers. I mean, now I think I'm off topic, but you got to get your hands dirty with data, and don't be afraid to ask an innovative question or a unique question, because I totally reject. And I know I can speak for you and so many of our colleagues. I totally reject that. Well, our students can't do original research until they're doctoral students, or our students can't do original research or innovative research until graduate school. Well, of course, that's nonsense. That's hogwash. So just do it. Overcome those trepidations. Feel free to ask, bold questions, innovative questions, and get your hands dirty. And you know what? If you don't find anything, or it's a bit of a mess, that's what research is. Research is messy, and that's okay, because we're all learning along the way. And the Holy Grail, I know, is to be able to get a peer-reviewed publication, but also I think presenting the research on campus, or regionally, or nationally, or discussing at a family dinner table what you research, all that has tremendous value. Or in a job interview, I can't tell you how many students came back to me. I mean, these are political science majors who obviously went on to do some chemistry work, but I got into pharmacy school because I talked about the research project I did in your class that I presented at the Southern Political Science Association, or I got this job. I landed this job with the state legislature because I talked about my research in such and such class and how I presented it at the National Conference on Undergraduate Research or the Georgia Political Science Association. Oh, that is so cool. And that's
It
the Holy Grail.
is, and I thank you for that because I think that's exactly right, that our students need to know that. And so I think that's a perfect place to end this tonight. But I thank you so much for being a part of this and for supporting undergraduate research for all these years at VSU. We couldn't have done it without you. So
Well,
thank you for everything.
hey, thank you. As you and I have talked about so many times over the years, it's a labor of love. And again, I'm grateful for all that you're doing, along with our Undergraduate Research Council, to just keep moving this forward and involve more and more students. And again, it's the best part of our job.
It is. I'll agree with that.
Yeah,
It's the most fun.
that's right. That's right.
All right. Well, thank you again and have a really good evening. I hope you get some rest.
Hey, thank you.
and
Thank you, Dr. Lovern. And again, I'm grateful for the invitation. And it's always fun to talk about undergraduate research.
It is. Well, thank you and take care.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.